Good evening. My name is Paul Holengraber, and I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library. As many of you know, my goal at the library is to make the lions roar. I often say that when the press particularly ask me what I'm doing, they ask me to say it in two words, and I've come up with this formulation to say that what I try to create is cognitive theater. What better way of doing it than with James Geary, who tonight, I am told, I have no idea what it might mean, will be juggling aphorisms. By that he means to say that he actually will be juggling and juggling aphorisms at the same time. You'll see that show in a little bit. Later this season, we have Bessanne Hardison coming to discuss the absence of color in the fashion industry and in the modeling industry. Myra Kelman next week, Carol Phillips and Ian Baruma, Benjamin Kunkel and Newt Gingrich discussing the environment. I'm sure that all of you are looking forward to Newt Gingrich's views on the environment. George Soros discussing for a whole day the influence and importance of Orwell, propaganda and the press. Peter Nadasch, Umberto Eco, Sis Notebaum, Nick Christoph discussing Darfur. The evening that I think nobody with any pretensions, literary or otherwise, will not want to miss is the evening with Pierre Bayard discussing his nicely entitled essay, How to Talk About Books You Haven't Read. I highly recommend it. It's something that I'm sure nobody in this audience has ever done. In order to keep you up to date, join our email list. If you have not so far, it's important you do because I keep adding programs. I have the pleasure of announcing a few of our new partnerships. We have Metro. Metro, the newspaper, is our media sponsor this year. We have 192 Books, which is our new bookseller partner. 192 Books is located at 192 10th Avenue. And James Geary will be signing, though he hasn't per se written all of the aphorisms, he will be signing his book on aphorisms. We also have Oriel, who's our wine sponsor on many evenings. You can actually come and enjoy the wine, come to Myra Kelman, and that will be the case. Become a friend of the New York Public Library and receive a discount of all future live events. And if you simply give $40 a year, 33% of your ticket is off. James Geary is the author of The World's Great Aphorists, which he will be signing after this show. I insist on the word show. Geary is the author previously of The World in a Phrase, which was the first book to explain, I'm told, the history of aphorisms. Now, after a year buried deep in the British Library, really poor soul, James has organized, indexed, and translated The World of Great Aphorists. From Geary, I trust we will learn tonight the difference between a simple quotation. I insist on the word quotation. Everybody always keeps using the word quote. And an aphorism. I, for one, love quotations. I don't know if any of you have learned or noticed this hearing me. I just cannot keep myself from quoting people, particularly when it's people like Oscar Wilde. My favorite Oscar Wilde quotation, before I mention another one to you, but maybe I'll only mention one, is Oscar Wilde famously said that it is only superficial people who do not judge by appearance. Now, I have no idea whether that's a quotation or an aphorism, and I'm somewhat at a loss, but somehow I feel that tonight I will be enlightened. James will lead us through this taxonomy while juggling aphorisms at the same time. And don't ask for more now. You'll see the performance. But just wait and see. And while you wait and see, Flash Rosenberg will start us off. Flash is our live artist in residence. We have one, and that's Flash. When I asked Flash what she was doing, she offered the following. She said, I convert quotes. I mean, terrible misuse. I convert quotations, I should have told her, into doodle, but I don't want to be a pedant. You know the story of two pedants who meet, and one pedant says to the other, you're a pedant, and the other one says, no, I'm a pedant. But that could go on for quite a long time. And that probably isn't an aphorism. anyway, it's a joke, and I mean it's probably fun. And are some jokes aphorisms? I just don't know. I convert quotations into doodled pictures while listening to discussions to create real-time conversation portraits. These are not caricatures, not verbatim notes, but a portrait of what it looks like to be listening. I illustrate comments sketched in real time. My job is to be an enthusiastic listener, not a fact checker. Some warbling of verisimilitude may have occurred between the time the comment was uttered, traveled to my ears, and landed on the paper in ink. I love this, this motion. And you know, on this very stage, Isabel Allende said that in Latin America, people talk about making love through the ear. So I think this works very nicely together. I'm not sure exactly how, but it does. I'm not a digital recording device, but a porous, amorphous human mind, prone to hear what I think I hear, which, as anyone who has ever taken an exam or been in love knows, is not necessarily exactly what was said. A drawing of this evening's program, along with finished and raw drawings from past live conversations, may be viewed in the hall after the event. Information for purchasing limited edition prints will be available. Now, I would like, at this particular moment, to welcome the porous, amorphous, magical human mind known as Flash Rosenberg.
Well, I want to know, how did this all get started? Maybe you'd be concerned about this. I mean, this is part of the mischief and spunk that Paul brings to the programs here. Made me think that we should all start to listen to the programs in a different way. So it all kind of began as a whim. You know, I brought paper and pen to an event just to see what would happen. And as the speakers began, you know, I began to draw. Now, this is from a conversation that Paul had with Adam Gopnik, and it was all talking about living in the city, and it was all in little angles. You could almost see them walking along, kind of at corners, discussing various things that were happening, and if you come up to the table afterwards, you'll see how, you know, the little quotes kind of go, the quotations. No, I only have a short time. If I say quotations, it'll take an extra minute. of what it is that they're actually saying that then bursts into drawing. So this is an organic process. It wasn't really a job I applied for. It's not an assignment with an end result or a deadline. It began as a freedom, an exploration, a luxury, and then I just kept doing it. I mean, this is a program that was on lust, and I thought, wow, I'm really going to learn something or be excited by something here, but it was all about little triangles and all the different ways that people have. But you see how the drawings kind of emerge from text and then go back into text. Now, I was already doing portraits of telephone calls. These are conversation portraits. I just thought I could be doing my work while preventing others from doing theirs. So you know that kind of thing that happens on a phone call where you're going, well, I don't know, maybe? And that this is the beginning of where conversation portraits came from. And these portraits, they're sort of purposely low-tech. I mean, in the room now, we've got a photographer with massive digital lenses, and there's video equipment happening, and that's what Paul was remarking that I had said before about this not needing to have the verisimilitude of what this actually looks like. You know, I'm not needed to do court sketches. I'm not obligated to do caricatures. In fact, I hate caricatures. They terrified me as a child. That someone would actually exaggerate something I already knew was wrong with me seemed absolutely disgusting. So I sort of stumble around on the paper. You know, it's a mess. It's like learning. It's, you know, it's just like thinking. This was Alberto Manguel who was talking with Paul, and they were talking about the library at night. And inside of all this text are quotations about being a writer. And the thing I try to do is not just be listening to it and making a good record or a good document of all the quotations, but in fact, to get the whole sense of it and simplify it. So what I was really struck by was what Manguel said about how being a writer didn't impress him. He viewed himself as a reader. He said, you know, a writer can write only what he knows, but a reader can read anything. I agree with Cocteau, who said that drawing is a way of writing when you've run out of the alphabet. And then he repaired his own quote by contradicting it and saying, I'm not really drawing, it's handwriting that's unraveling. Which brings us to quote repair, which is what I promised I would do tonight. I mean, when I'm listening to these and when you're listening to these lectures, don't some of the things that people say sound so fancy and so snazzy? And then you go home and you think about it, well, I don't know. That's not what I agree with. Perhaps I doubt it. And you have to actually think about these quotes because they can go in so many directions. Now, I've been interested in quotes for a long time. In junior high school, in seventh grade, I had the best job ever in that I got to read the lunch for the day. And I thought, well, for having food for thought, food for lunch, why not food for thought? And so I added quotations that I thought I needed to make up. But I only knew cliches at that point. So I thought, busy as a beaver. Well, here's a self-repairing quote. Contrary to popular belief, beavers are not busy. Most of the time, they're just horsing around. Zen sayings. No snowflake falls in the wrong place. Quote reaction? So why shovel? One cannot always be a hero, but one can always be a man. Of course, then there's the quote retort. Unless you are a woman and do not exist in quotes about humankind in other centuries. Happy are those who have no doubt of themselves. But of course, this opens itself to numerous quote variations. Stupid are those who have no doubt of themselves. Of course, you can use that first word and put anything in of people who have no doubt of themselves. He that asketh faintly beggeth a denial, which has begs the quote reprimand. He that speaketh with so much eth is beggeth to everyone to shut up. Wit is the salt of conversation, not the food. But this lends itself to a quote reverse, which says, food causes witless conversation about salt. He who has a garden and a library wants for nothing. Very nice to do in a library, but that's the universal quote riddle. He who has a blank and a blank wants for nothing. So at this moment, think about the two things that you want, and then we'll have a whole audience of people who want for nothing. Ready? So get your first word in place. He who has a peanut butter sandwich and a wants for nothing. Of course, we can do it as a quote recalculation. He who has a blank and a blank has nothing. Here's something from the fifth Beatle. I am nothing, but truth is everything, said Abe Lincoln. And in the quote remix, it's getting hard to be someone, but everything is nothing, is real. Nothing to get hung about. I am you and you are me and we are all together. I am the walrus, goo 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 tube. Can you tell I just saw across the universe? And one to toss away. All work and no play make Jack a dull boy. And in quote rearranged, we have dull work and no boys makes one jack off. Now, quotes in words are not the only thing that need to be repaired. There are visual quotes as well, since I'm trafficking between words and pictures. Here we have a smiley face, right? Have a nice day. Beautiful quote, very universal. Have you ever seriously had a nice day upon being wished have a nice day? No, I haven't. That's because you're not getting the whole picture. What you're really seeing is just this. And then when you add in the rest, oops, thicker pen. You're actually being wished to have a nice cow snout. Then there are all kinds of quotes to do civic good in the world. Like at my nephew's high school, they gave out these pencils that said, "It's not cool to do drugs." And of course, they immediately repaired this by sharpening the pencil down until it said, "Cool to do drugs." Now, earlier in the evening, some of you may have noticed me. I tried to wear my best quote dress and be noticeable. And collected quotes from everybody in the audience, figuring you couldn't just come and listen to aphorisms and quotations. You have to bring your own in. So this is part of the exchange that happens here at Live. And so I wanted to show a little of how I take words and draw it into an image. So I need to have somebody pull one of these quotes out of this hat. Let's see. You do it? Hope impedes adaptation. Hope impedes adaptation. Let's see. Okay, so we have hope here. And she's looking impeded. Now, I think adaptation is trying to come in, and she won't let it. Okay, and here comes adaptation, because it can just be anything at once. And it's impeded. And so here's hope. Impedes adaptation. See, I don't even have to understand the quotes. I can just draw them. Do we have time for another one?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay, let's see. There was some ringers in there. Let's see. You want to pick one out? Okay. Oh, good. It's written this way. If you have a garden and a library, you have everything you need. Bingo! Did we get extra points for that? That's a very fine quote. If you have a blank and a blank. Okay, let's try another one. I have won a million. Oh. The early bird catches the worm. Is it fair for you to pick your own quote? All things are fair when you're dealing with quotes. The early bird, what does it do to the worm? Catches them? All right, here comes an early bird. I don't know how to, let's see, early. It must be because it's sunshine. He's flying around. It's very early. And the worm is going to go by, and he's going to catch it to go to work, but it looks like a subway. Because I haven't seen a worm in a long time. I don't know what they look like. But I think they look a lot like subways, and he's going to get to the subway in time. It's waiting. Okay. I didn't say these were going to be good. I just said I was going to do them. Okay. I think it's time for me to sit down and draw the lecture. Thank you very, very much.
Good evening, everyone. I will be talking about aphorisms this evening, and I will be keeping with the interactive theme of the evening. I want to warn you in advance that there is some gentle audience participation. Now, if you do not wish to participate in the gentle audience participation, please recoil in horror as I approach your chair. The second announcement that I have to make is that there will be exactly no time at the end of this talk for questions. That means if you have a question, you must ask it during this talk. And that also goes for aphorisms. If you have an aphorism, a saying, a quote that needs to be repaired, I encourage you to stand up and testify. This is an interactive evening, and I would love to hear the aphorisms that have been occupying you for your whole lives, that have been stuck in your head for your whole lives. The third announcement I have to start off with is, by the end of this talk, I promise it will become clear why I am holding a globe. So, aphorisms are the oldest literary art form on the planet. They are also the most intimate literary art form on the planet. Therefore, my talk will be a mix of personal and literary anecdote. And I'd like to start by just saying a little bit about how I discovered aphorisms and why I love them so much. I first discovered aphorisms when I was 8 years old in the most unlikely of places, that is Reader's Digest magazine. Is anyone familiar with that magazine here in the audience, by any chance? Well, then you will know that in the quotable quote section, there is in every issue a half a dozen or a dozen quotable quotes from people like Oprah Winfrey. Dr. Phil McGraw is very popular these days, I understand. He's apparently a TV counselor, gives people advice on television. One of his aphorisms that I really enjoy doesn't apply to me, unfortunately, but if you marry for money, you will earn every penny. Now, when I was eight, I found a copy of Reader's Digest magazine on the floor of the bathroom in my family home. Slightly mildewed, the pages were damp, but I opened it and I discovered quotable quotes. And from that day on, ladies and gentlemen, to this, I have been obsessed by aphorisms. And why am I obsessed by aphorisms? Very good question. When I was eight, obviously, I didn't know the difference between an aphorism and an aphrodisiac. But there was something about these short, witty, philosophical sayings that completely entranced me. I was just becoming a serious reader at around eight, starting to read novels and longer stories and things like that. And I was absolutely amazed about how much meaning could be compressed into such a small space. And I could turn over a single saying in my head and find a sort of kaleidoscope of different interpretations. And it was the wordplay, the intensity of the language. It seemed to me that it was literature at its most intense. and I just loved it. And from that moment on, I was addicted. And when I was a teenager, I started collecting aphorisms. Now, if you're going to collect aphorisms, you either have to do one of two things. You either have to have a very, very good memory, which I do not, or you have to make some kind of record of the aphorisms and write them down as you come across them. And that was my preferred method. So as any 12 or 13-year-old, I had posters of rock stars in my bedroom, and David Bowie, George Harrison, Pink Floyd. And one by one, I flipped the posters over so that they faced, the picture faced the wall, and I started scribbling the quotes on the back. Oh, sorry, the quotations. I shouldn't even say quotations. They're aphorisms. I will we'll find the difference later. And I still have these posters, and they still hang in on the walls of my study. And they function like a sort of book of snapshots, of intellectual snapshots. And from that moment, when I was 8, when I first discovered aphorisms, important milestones in my life have happened in coincidence with aphorisms. Sometimes the aphorism made the event happen, and sometimes the event happened along with an aphorism, or an aphorism came to me when the event happened that was helpful. For example, when I was 16, I started to play the violin, and I will never forget Samuel Butler's remarkable aphorism: life is like playing a violin solo in public and learning the instrument as one goes along. That's sort of like what giving talks about aphorisms is like as well. Gerard Manley Hopkins, I was very, very fond of his poetry for a long time, and his phrase still rings in my ears: the effect of masterpieces is to make me admire and do otherwise. Now, once you become obsessed with aphorisms, you start seeing them absolutely everywhere. And in fact, they are absolutely everywhere, if you know where to look. Just a few examples. A few months ago, I was riding in a train, and a young man, a teenager, was walking down the corridor of the train, and he had long hair, he looked like a real party animal, and he had a t-shirt on, and on his t-shirt, it said, "A weekend wasted is not a wasted weekend." Now, I know there are young children in the audience, and I'm not saying I endorse these kind of sentiments, but I thought that was a very clever aphorism. I live in London, and I don't know if Thierry Henry says, that name says anything to anybody here, but he's that man in the back knows his football players, soccer players, I should say. He's a French soccer star. And he was on billboards in London for the longest time advertising, I haven't got the faintest idea what, sneakers or credit cards or something, but his tagline was, "I hate to lose, but I'm not afraid to fail." Great aphorism. I got an email from someone who read my book, and it's great when you write a book about aphorisms. People come up to you in the street or on email and say, "Is this an aphorism?" And this one happened to be an aphorism. This woman's boss said, "I thought it over until I overthought it." And she said, "Is that an aphorism?" And I said, "Yes, that is an aphorism, and your boss should be in my book." So, for me, aphorisms really can, and in my personal experience, really have changed my life. And I'd just like to give you a few quick examples of how that is, because it happens on a very, very small scale, and it can happen on a very, very large scale. On the small scale, we all have periods in our professional lives where we're going through a little bit of a dip. And I was having one of these periods. And in fact, one of the very first aphorisms I ever read still is in my head. And at this particular period in my professional life, it was in my head every morning when I woke up. So I got up, raised my head from the pillow, sat up in bed, and the first thought, literally the first thought that crossed my mind was, "The difference between a rut and a grave is the depth." Now you can tell what kind of a dip I was in by the fact that was the first thing that crossed my mind. And it's not a very pleasant thing to have cross your mind first thing in the morning. But, and that's one of the reasons why I love aphorisms. It is because they do not make you feel good about yourself. And that is a very important thing not to feel. Aphorisms are much more challenging. They're much more provocative, and they're much more thought-provoking. When you hear a good aphorism, like the difference between a rut and a grave is the depth, you definitely do not lie back in bed and put the snooze button on. You get up and you think, what the hell am I doing with my life and how am I going to get out of this rut? So this is really the life-changing potential that aphorisms have, in my opinion. And even on a macro scale, not long ago, about almost 2 years ago, in a couple months, I learned that I had been laid off from my job. And this was in January. I just come back from Christmas, New Year's break, came into the office, not very refreshed at all. But the first thing that happened was my boss called me into his office and said, we need to talk. And so I went into his office, I sat down, he did most of the talking, it was a very short conversation, and he said my job had been eliminated. Now, that's a shocking thing to have happen to you. It's a very bizarre thing to have happen to you. I worked as a journalist, and so I knew that something called the internet, is apparently really popular these days, was causing a lot of changes in the publishing world. So everyone was feeling a little unstable. But through this amazing psychological self-preservation mechanism that we all have, I never thought it could happen to me. When it did happen to me, I was completely dumbfounded. I was completely dumbfounded. And for the first few moments after I got the news, I literally had no thoughts. I was a complete blank. And it took me a few seconds before various really vague kind of thoughts and feelings of, you know, financial terror for one, and grief, and also a weird sense of relief that a very difficult time was finally over. These started creeping in. But when I could actually think again, the very first thing I thought of was an aphorism. And an aphorism by a man named Wilhelm Eklund, who was a Swedish aphorist, lived at the beginning of the last century. And his aphorism is, to be placed on treacherous ground is good. It is only when the ground is rocking beneath us that we learn to stand on our own 2 feet. Now, an interesting thing about that aphorism is it did not solve my problem. It did not, in any way, shape, or form, solve the problem. What it did do, however, was give me a feeling that I could make a soft landing and I could even hit the ground running, that this was not the end of the world. It was just the end of my job. So another funny thing about getting fired is suddenly you don't have anything to do with the office. So I went home, and that evening, after talking it over with my wife, we decided that we would tell our children what had happened. And I have 3 kids, and 2 of whom at that time were old enough to understand what happened. So I had this really elaborate speech prepared, because obviously the last thing I wanted to do was to give my children the impression that the ground was rocking underneath their dad's feet. So I had a really iron-cast story ready for them. And so, you know, it was bedtime, and they were getting ready to go to sleep. And I went in, I said, well, boys, there's been some changes at work, and I'm not going to be going to the office anymore, and I'm not going to be working as hard as I used to work or as long, and eventually I'm going to find a new office, and I'll go to a new job. And in the middle of this story, my younger son interrupted, and he said, you mean you're fired? For the second time in one day, I found myself completely dumbfounded. And I thought about it for a minute, and I said, yeah, I'm fired. And he said, woohoo, Dad's going to be home more often. So I realized 2 things after that little experience. One was, my son sure has his head on straight. And the second was that I still had plenty of solid ground beneath my feet. So that's why I love aphorisms. Now, to answer Paul's question, what is an aphorism? It's not easy to define an aphorism. And the only way you can really define an aphorism is by juggling. And, of course, Geary's five laws of the aphorism. Now, the observant among you in the audience will notice that I am holding three balls, but there are, in fact, five laws of the aphorism. And the reason for the discrepancy in the numbers is that juggling five balls is really, really hard. And I can't do it. But what I can do is juggle with three balls and explain to you the five laws of the aphorism. And they go like this. Just need to get a little bit warmed up. The first law of the aphorism is it must be brief. Why? Because only a fool gives a speech in a burning house. The second law is it must be definitive. There are no ifs, ands, or buts in aphorisms. Samuel Johnson, a great dictionary maker, is a good example of the definitive aphorism. He said, "Patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel." Now, note that I do not say an aphorism must be true. The truth or otherwise of an aphorism is completely irrelevant. That's for the reader to decide. As exemplified by another great dictionary maker, Ambrose Bierce, who begged to differ with Dr. Johnson, and he said, "Patriotism is the first refuge of a scoundrel." Okay. Whoa! Hold on. That didn't go as planned, but okay. Quick recovery. Third law of the aphorism. It must be personal. Aphorisms have an author. This is the difference between an aphorism and a proverb. To quotation Oscar Wilde again. How do you like that one, Paul? "To love oneself is the beginning of a lifelong romance." That's got Oscar Wilde written all over it. Okay, the fourth law is it must be philosophical. This is what makes an aphorism different from a platitude. Love means never having to say you're sorry. Well, apart from being ridiculous, in my experience, love means having to say you're sorry on a regular basis. That's a platitude. It's not philosophical. It doesn't make you think. It makes you kind of sit back into kind of gooey complacency. So it must be philosophical. There we go. Okay, now the fifth law, the fifth and final law, this is what makes aphorisms like jokes. In fact, aphorisms in many ways are jokes shorn of everything except the punchline. There's a moment when you get an aphorism, just like you get a joke. And this is why aphorisms are also like juggling. Aphorisms have a verbal or a psychological or a literary flip. They lift you up and put you down in a place where you least expect it to be. This is why, ladies and gentlemen, the fifth law of the aphorism is it must have a twist. Yes! Okay. Okay, one of my favorite aphorisms is leave your luck while you're still winning. So I regret to inform you that's all we have time for this evening. Okay, now this is the audience participation part. So remember, recoil in horror. I'm going to go out amongst you, pass this globe around, and I would ask that whoever gets the globe, take an aphorism from the globe, read it aloud, then I will say a few things about that aphorist and that aphorism. Now, but it's more interesting than that, because there are also blank strips of paper in the globe. Now, if you pick a blank strip of paper from the globe, you can either have what's behind door number two, or you can name any theme, and I have to be able to cite an aphorism that's related to that theme. If I fail, thanks to the generosity of Bloomsbury USA, you get a free copy of the book. But if I don't fail, you owe me $19.95. That's fair, isn't it? So there's a few ground rules. It has to be general enough that I have a fighting chance, okay? So 14th century Chinese landscape painting is right out. But art or painting is perfectly acceptable. Now, Paul, for example, if he drew a blank strip, which he will not, I guarantee you, he might say, the New York Public Library. I don't know any aphorisms about the New York Public Library, but I do know lots of aphorisms about libraries and books. So that would qualify. For example, Samuel Johnson, again, there is no greater testament to the vanity of human hopes than a public library. And as a mid-list author, I can really identify with that remark. So, now for me, I have to be able to either paraphrase the aphorism or cite the aphorist who wrote it, because there's nothing worse than misquoting an aphorism. And if I can paraphrase it or cite the aphorist, then I can look at the book to get the... But I have to be able to say a little bit first to get, you know, because I don't want to misquote it, because that's terrible. So... Is that clear? Are there any questions? Are there any aphorisms? Are there any answers? No. Okay. So we'll start the bidding down here with this gentleman, who is a duty-free husband. He's got it written on his T-shirt, which is not an aphorism. Just so you know. Yeah, flash can. You have to read it aloud. Wait for the microphone.
Okay, thank you.
And I do want the globe back.
Be like a postage stamp. Be like a postage stamp. Stick to one thing until you get there.
All right. Did you get that? Be like a postage stamp. Stick to one thing till you get there. Now, that is an aphorism by a man named Josh Billings. Has anyone heard of Josh Billings? You have heard of Josh Billings? Okay. It's not a bad thing. Josh Billings was a contemporary of Mark Twain, and he was about 10 years older than Mark Twain. And for a long time, he was much more famous than Mark Twain. And Josh Billings is one of a long line of American aphorists that started with Benjamin Franklin, who adopted Benjamin Franklin, Poor Richard's Almanac. These aphorists who are very highly cultured, very intelligent, well-read people who adopted these down-home, homely philosopher, countrified bumpkin personas. And Josh Billings, his real name was Henry Wheeler Shaw, and his father was a state congressman from Massachusetts this is the mid-19th century, who at that time was the youngest congressman ever in the United States. And when Josh went out west to make his fortune, he took with him letters of recommendation from two presidents and a sitting Supreme Court judge. That's how well-connected his father was. It was all to no avail because he got out west, tried to make his fortune in various occupations, gold mining and all that kind of stuff. And, of course, he failed and he became bankrupt and he was stranded in some godforsaken place, Mississippi. No offense to anyone from Mississippi, but we're talking 1850 here. It was not nice. And he needed money. And so what he decided to do was to give a lecture on mesmerism, which was a very popular topic at the time. And he completely ad-libbed this lecture. And it was a huge hit. And he not only earned enough money to get himself out of Mississippi or wherever he was, but he hit on his vocation for the rest of his life. After that, he went back to New England, where he was from, and he became a sort of columnist, what we would today recognize as a columnist. And he was the one who started the mid-19th century fad of lecture tours, authors who gave lecture tours. And Mark Twain made a fortune giving lectures all around the world, and it was a sort of a 19th century equivalent of the stand-up comedy circuit. And Billings was incredibly funny, but he was also very, very philosophical. And he's a good example of the aphorism as joke. I'll just read you a few of his. First of all, his first one I'm going to read is a great example of why aphorisms are so potent. Brevity is power. Oh, that was a serious one. You were not supposed to laugh at that one. I'm just going to read you a few of Josh Billings' greatest hits. There are lots of people who mistake their imagination for their memory. Man was created a little lower than the angels, and he has been getting a little lower ever since. The best reformers the world has ever seen are those who commence on themselves. So he can be funny, but he can also be very, very poignant. To bring up a child in the way he should go, travel that way yourself once in a while. And this one, I think, is also a really, really inspirational one. To finish is to win. Okay, around and around she goes. Where she stops, nobody knows. Could you pass that down there to the lady in the sort of orangey scarf? Need a microphone?
In the adversity of even our best friends, we always find something not wholly displeasing.
Ouch! That was, François La Rochefoucauld. What can I say about him? He was a total bastard. Let me just find him here. La Rochefoucauld, here we go. So La Rochefoucauld was a 17th century French nobleman, and he's from a long line of La Rochefoucaulds who had the best of everything in France, and he himself had the best of everything. He was born wealthy, he was born connected, he had everything he could possibly want, including a library and a garden, which I happened to visit over the summer, and very nice they are too. His house, his chateau, is still there, and it's still lived in by his descendants. He was a born plotter. He didn't place a high value on integrity or honesty or anything like that. And he also had an uncanny knack of choosing the wrong side in every battle that he got himself into. So there was a very absurd period of French history called the Fronde, where the various shifting factions of noble persons fought other shifting factions of noble persons for the things that noble persons like to have. And La Rochefoucauld inevitably got on the wrong side of every single shifting faction that he joined. As a result, he was wounded in battle. He nearly lost his eyesight. He had all his houses and possessions taken away from him. He was exiled to the outskirts of Paris and sent away from the center of its cultural and intellectual life. And funnily enough, it's at that period in his life when he got interested in aphorisms. He started reading the Stoics, and then he started writing aphorisms of his own. Now, what's fascinating about one of the many things that are fascinating about La Rochefoucauld is that he practiced what is called the long-form composition method of aphorisms. There's two ways to write aphorisms. Spontaneous combustion, where it comes out basically on the first go, and you write it on the back of a napkin, and that's it. Or you do what La Rochefoucauld did, and he would attend one of these literary salons that were very popular, and he was very popular at these salons. And after a night of drinking and eating and discussing love and great intellectual topics, he would retreat to his study and he'd scribble out 3 or 4 pages of thoughts and excerpts of conversation on that particular topic. He'd whittle it down to 1 or 2 sentences. And then, even more interesting, what he would do is he would show it to Madame de Sablé, who was his close personal friend, and also the hostess of one of the most prominent literary salon in Paris. Now, he didn't consider an aphorism finished until Madame de Sablé had approved it. What makes it even more interesting is that she herself was no mean aphorist in her own right. And in the book, I've compiled some aphorisms from both of them that are really on the same subject. And it's very interesting to look at them because it's really hard to tell who influenced whom. Was Madame de Sablé influenced by La Rochefoucauld, as you would think, because he's got the better reputation historically? Or was it actually the other way around, that La Rochefoucauld was acting as a sort of editor for Madame de Sablé's aphorisms, because her aphorisms are always much, much longer than his, and his are much, much shorter and sharper. So I'm going to start read a few of his, and then we'll do a compare and contrast exercise, and there'll be a quiz later. Okay. How comes it that our memories are good enough to retain even the minutest details of what has befallen us, but not to recollect how many times we have recounted them to the same person? About 18 months ago, I lost my job, and it was very upsetting. I don't know if you ever had that experience, but before strongly desiring anything, we should look carefully into the happiness of its present owner. When the vices give us up, we flatter ourselves that we are giving them up. When you cannot find peace in yourself, it is useless to look for it elsewhere. I think this one sums up La Rochefoucauld's sort of morbid, cynical take on humanity. Our enemies are nearer to the truth in their opinion of us than we are of ourselves. Here's some compare and contrast. Here's Madame de Sablé. If we took as much trouble to be what we should be as we take to deceive others by disguising what we are, we could appear as we really are without having the trouble of disguising ourselves. Here's La Rochefoucauld. It is as easy to deceive ourselves without noticing. It is as easy to deceive ourselves without noticing it as it is hard to deceive others without their noticing. It is such a great fault to talk too much that in business and conversation, if what is good is also brief, it is doubly good, and one gains by brevity what one often loses by an excess of words. Madame de Sablé. True eloquence consists in saying all that is required and only what is required. La Rochefoucauld. You decide. America decides. Oh, I have another. Oh, every time I walk past that. Would you like to take an aphorism from the Globe?
It's blank.
Oh, no. Okay, I haven't really warmed up yet, so be gentle with me. Come on, there's a book at stake here.
Illness?
Illness? You're a cheerful guy. I have one on illness. I accept personal checks, Visa, MasterCard. I just have to remember it. Health, wealth, and sleep, to be truly appreciated, must be interrupted. You want to go best out of three, or...? Salad? Oh, who said it? Salad. Salad. I have one on food. That wasn't part of the game. I didn't have to know who said it. I just had to be able to cite it. I think it was... I'm going to have to look... I can't remember. We can look it up in the book later. How? I have the book right here. What was the question? salad. There's a good one about food, but I don't want to misquote it. It's by a guy named Jean-Anthelme Brillat, who was a French gourmand. And he wrote a wonderful book about eating, which I can't remember the name of that either. But I highly recommend it. And it's about food. Just give me a minute here. Here we go. The discovery of a new dish does more for the happiness of mankind than the discovery of a star. Ain't it the truth? Okay. We need another aphorism. Oh, sorry. I just don't hope it's not blank. It's blank! Oh, no. You're kidding me.
It's only blank on one side.
Oh, it's only blank on one side. All right, everybody's an aphorist all of a sudden.
Under a government which imprisons any unjustly, the true place for a just man is also a prison.
Did you get that? No. Under a government which imprisons any unjustly, the true place for a just man is also a prison. Henry David Thoreau, blank on one side. Now, I have a confession to make. When I was 15, I was arrested for possession of marijuana. Yeah, I know, I hear you gasp. I have paid my debt to society. I am a reformed man. I happened to make the mistake of getting arrested in Ocean City, New Jersey. Which, as some of you may know, you can't even get a drink there, much less smoke marijuana. So I was under the boardwalk having a wonderful time and finished doing what I was doing there and then walked up to the boardwalk and there was a police officer standing there who obviously had detected some strange aromas emanating from under the boardwalk. And I was arrested. I was 15. He put the cuffs on me. I was not really a menace to society. Let me just say that up front. He put the cuffs on me, threw me in the back of the car, took me to the police station. They did a strip search. They took away my shoelaces, my belt, and then they put me in a cell. And, you know, I was mildly upset, I think you can say. My main concern, well, there were basically two things going through my mind at this time. The first was, obviously, how can I prevent my parents from finding out about this? And secondly, I thought to myself, what would Henry David Thoreau do in a situation like this? Because when I was 15, I had been reading Walden more or less continuously for about 2 years. So I would read the book, and when I got to the end, I would go back to the beginning and I would read it again. And if you go back and have a look at Walden, you'll see it's not really a book at all. It's like a collection of aphorisms stacked on top of one another, like a log pile. And this book completely changed my life. And there are a few books in the world that can completely change your life. And for me, this was one. And of course, this aphorism that you just picked is from, not from Walden, but Civil Disobedience. There's the occasion for that essay was when Thoreau was living out at Walden. He made frequent trips into town. He's socializing to visit Ralph Waldo Emerson, his good buddy, to babysit their kids, to do various things. He was not at all a hermit. And on one of these trips, he bumped into Sam Staples, who was the local police officer. And Sam said, "Hank, when are you going to pay your poll tax?" And Thoreau said, "I'm not going to pay the poll tax, Sam, as you well know, because I object to the imperialist war that the government is waging, I think, against Mexico at that time." So Thoreau refused to pay his poll tax out of principle because he objected to the war. And Sam Staples said to him, "Look, you have to pay your poll tax, and if you don't pay it, the next time I see you, I'm going to arrest you." Okay, Thoreau didn't pay his poll tax. He went into town to have his shoe repaired. Sam Staples saw him, said, have you paid your poll tax? Thoreau said, no. And he was arrested. And Henry David Thoreau spent exactly one night in jail. And someone, to this day, it's still unknown who, paid his poll tax for him. And the next day he was released. Naturally, when I was sitting in a cell in Ocean City, New Jersey, I was thinking, this is my Thoreau moment. I can't fail. So I was seriously thinking, well, you know, what can I do? So then the police officer came in and he said, they were real jerks, I have to say. I mean, I was 15. It was really unnecessary. Anyway, he came in and said, name. And I said, Fifth Amendment. And it was more like, Fifth Amendment! Because I was totally shattered, and I was in tears, and you know, tears were streaming down my face. I was very, very upset. But I thought, I mean, what can they do? They're going to hold me overnight. I really didn't want my parents to find out. I would say, I'd make up some excuse, I was abducted by aliens, whatever, but I'm okay now, and it would be fine. So when he asked me what my name was, I said, Fifth Amendment. And you know, he just, you know, he scoffed. He said, what's your name? There was a word in between what and oh, your and name, but there's children in the audience. And I said, Fifth Amendment. And he said, Joe! And he got up and he stormed out. And Joe came in, and Joe was the real hard ass. And Joe said, what's going on? And he told him that I wouldn't tell him my name. And he said, look, you tell us your name or you're going to spend the rest of your life here. I was like, Fifth Amendment. And I didn't tell him. And he said, all right, lock him up. And so they threw me back in the cell. I sat there for a couple, an hour or 90 minutes. And then the good cop came in. And this was Dan or somebody else. And he sat beside me and said, come on, man, this can't go on. Just tell us your name and it'll all be over. You know, you made a mistake. It happens to everybody. And I said, Fifth Amendment. And he said, well, you know, if you do that, you're gonna be here. You're not going to leave. And I didn't tell him. So I was pacing around my cell, you know, reading all the graffiti that was on the cell there. Very exciting it was. And I happened to stand up on the little bench and look out the window with the bars on it. And I saw my mother's car. And I thought, what is going on here? This is my Thoreau moment, and I see my mother's car outside. I had gotten arrested with my cousin. 5 minutes after we were at the police station, he told him exactly where I lived, what my social security number was. It was awful. And this whole thing was for nothing because the police knew my name and address the whole time. Anyway, it was really humiliating. But Thoreau is, for me, he's not one of the all-time great aphorists. But for me, he's one of the most important aphorists because he's had such a huge impact on my life. And here are a couple. Keep pace with his a different drummer. Let him step to the music which he hears, however measured or far away. If you have built castles in the air, your work need not be lost. That is where they should be. Now put the foundations under them. And this is my all-time favorite. I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and to see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. Okay. Anybody have any questions? Excellent.
A lot of them are palindromic, where it's kind of reversed. First, when I heard of aphorisms, that's what I thought they were. I thought they were palindromic. Can you just explain some of the history of that?
Yes. Did everyone hear the question? He's saying that many aphorisms are palindromic in that they have a reversal in them, a sort of flipping of terminology. And in fact, in the book, not only are there five laws of the aphorism, but there are eight types of aphorism, and they're listed in here. And one of the types is not the palindrome, but the chiasmus. And the chiasmus, just a Greek word that means flip, but it sounds nicer in a book, is essentially a sentence which has two components. And in the first part, it's A is B, and the second part is B is A. And this is a very, very common, you're absolutely right, it's a very, very common style of aphorism. And one of the greatest examples of it is by Mae West, who not many people would recognize as an aphorist. But she says, it's not the men in your life that matter, it's the life in your men. Okay. Have an aphorism. Don't take a blank one.
No snowflake in an avalanche ever feels responsible.
You get the one? No snowflake in an avalanche ever feels responsible. That is one of my all-time, that's in my top 10 favorite aphorisms. And it's definitely by one of my top 10 favorite aphorists. And his name is Stanislav Jerzy Lecz. And he is somewhere in here. Okay, there he is. He was born in the heyday of, well, he sort of died in 1967 or 62. So he was born at the sort of end of the Habsburg Empire in what is now Poland. And he was a strange hybrid because he was from a sort of minor nobility. And he was very, very proud of his noble lineage. But after the Second World War, he became a communist, which is not a very an easy mixture that goes together. But during the war, he was a Jew, and during the war, he was picked up by the Germans, and he was interred in a concentration camp. And he managed to escape from the concentration camp by donning a guard's uniform, a stolen guard's uniform, and walking right out the front door. Absolutely amazing story. He then entered the resistance, first as a sort of partisan, a fighter, and then he became active in the resistance in terms of propaganda, and he became a devout communist. And after the war was over and the communists took over, he became an apparatchik, and he got a very plum posting to Vienna, the home of Karl Kraus, who was a great Viennese aphorist and a role model for Lecz. But he became disillusioned, shall we say, with communism. But he never lost his gift as a propagandist. So his aphorisms managed to circumvent the censorship that was prevalent in the time because they're so clever and the actual meaning is so well hidden that the censors really didn't know what the hell he was talking about. So it's a very, very interesting use of the propagandist's art for anti-propaganda purposes or propaganda for the right kind of propaganda, shall we say. And Lecz is one of my favorites because he's incredibly funny, but he's also incredibly philosophical, and he's incredibly timely. He's not off in some sort of abstract realm. And he's incredibly poetic. His aphorisms are just very, very dense pieces of imagery as well as great aphorisms. And I think a lot of his political aphorisms are very, very appropriate to today's times. Tired rebels rest in the armchairs of power. The strongest breaks fail on the path of least resistance. The weakest link in the chain is also the strongest. It can break the chain. The constitution of a country should not violate the constitution of its citizens. The window on the world can be covered by a newspaper. Sometimes it takes a little bit, and then they sink in. The mob shouts with one big mouth and eats with 1,000 little ones. Optimists and pessimists differ only on the date of the end of the world. In the beginning was the word, at the end, just the cliche. Okay, I just want to close now with another little personal anecdote. It has to do with my father. When I was 8, he and I used to play a game where I would run from, in our house, you could run from the living room into the dining room, into the kitchen, into the hallway, back into the living room again. And we used to play a game whereby I would run that circuit, and we timed how long it took me to do that, and it was 8 seconds. And he would be sitting on the sofa in the living room, and he would count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And at 7, he'd release the miniature plastic Philadelphia Eagles football that we had into the archway of the hallway. And all the time I was motoring around to emerge in the hallway at the stroke of 8. And we got it down to a perfection, hardly ever missed. Now, my father was someone I've never seen him actually hold a book in his hands. And to be honest with you, I never think he ever read a book in his entire life. And as I grew older and I got into literature and poetry and aphorisms, it seemed that he and I didn't have much in common anymore. He was great with words, though. He was a salesman of aluminum siding and insurance. So he had to be witty and persuasive every single day in his job. When he died, I cleaned out his desk. And there was lots of insurance policies and brochures detailing the wonders of aluminum siding. And in one drawer, I found a stack about that high of pages torn from one of those quotes for the day desktop calendars. And I thought, oh my God. My father collected aphorisms too. And I thought, in that instant, my entire opinion of him was completely changed. I had no idea that he collected aphorisms. He had no idea that I collected aphorisms. We never talked about it. At that moment, I also realized that my love of aphorisms was something that my father passed to me. And one of the aphorisms that was in his stack of papers struck me particularly because it's one of my favorite aphorisms by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And it is, life consists of what a man is thinking of all day. And I should say, man or woman, Flash. What a person is thinking of all day. That's exactly what aphorisms are. Aphorisms give you good thoughts. Because life is what you're thinking of all day. What happens in here affects what happens out there just as much as the other way around. So for me, there's another great aphorism by Logan Pearsall Smith that goes, people say life is the thing, but I prefer reading. For me, there's no difference. Literature is life. And aphorisms are literature and life distilled down to its very essence. Aphorisms are the real elixir of life. So I urge you to drink deep and drink long, and don't forget to pass it on. Thank you very much.